Hi, this is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. You're listening to a previously recorded show, Foundations of Estate Planning. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it's another edition of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant. Hi there, Paul.
Hello, Mark.
Good to see you once again.
Thank you.
And good to get into a discussion, kind of a refresher course, kind of the foundations of your counseling practice at Planning with Purpose.
Yeah.
And what you do there, the kind of questions you ask anyone who comes in for services with you. And so let's get into it. What are some of those foundational questions?
Yeah, I really wanted to take an opportunity to think through not just what it would look like if somebody were to come into the office and some of the questions that we ask, but I want to really want to get into the foundation of why we ask what we ask, and really what is the importance of that question and how does it influence the overall estate plan. And in addition, I've reviewed hundreds and hundreds of other documents, and some of the things that we talk about in our office, I never see in another document. And it makes me scratch my head of, well, why are other documents absent of what I would suggest is a lot of information? And I think a lot of other documents are developed out of a template mentality instead of a relationship mentality. And so then the questions may not be as deep. They may not be as thoughtful. There may not be as many questions to anticipate the contingencies. And so typically when clients get done with my process, they talk about how in-depth it was, how thorough it was. And really what I am trying to do is think through what's the worst case scenario that could happen for my client? And if I can build a plan that will be upheld and withstand the worst case scenario, then certainly it can withstand the best case scenario. Because we have a vision in our brain that if I were to become disabled, incapacitated, in other words, need help during my lifetime, or if I were to die, that everything is going to line up exactly perfect. Well, I'm sorry to break some bad news to everybody out there, but that rarely happens. Mm. It's unfortunate, but the vision that we have is oftentimes not realized because we can't manipulate and control people any longer if we die. And now we got emotions built in. We've got sibling rivalries built in. We've got interpretation built in. And so documents that are made with basic information then lend to greater discourse, and they lend to the opportunity for more, I guess, just problems or things to arise. Mm. Versus if we take our time now at the beginning and we develop a really good, strong document, we talk about the contingencies, we talk about what is your passion and your heart for your family, what does the Lord put into your heart that you would like to be carried out should you become incapacitated or should you die? And when we have deeper discussions, deeper relationship with the client, then we can develop a document, so I believe, that is going to be upheld and withstand not just the test of time, but the scenarios that may arise. I hope they don't, right? I hope the beneficiaries live a perfect, good life. Mm. But what happens when the beneficiary goes through a divorce that we didn't anticipate? What happens when the beneficiary is in a car accident, has a health incident? And then what happens to what we've left behind? And so there's a lot of in-depth questions that when someone comes into our office that we ask, and it is a thorough process. So I wanted to give listeners a peek inside of what would happen if they were to come in, and the depth of questioning, and then, like I said, the reasoning behind why we actually are asking what we ask. Mm. So there's kind of the foundation of what I'd like to discuss here for probably a good couple shows, and let's get to the why of what I ask instead of just here's what I ask.
Yeah, and why do you ask some of these questions? Yeah. I know something you're really concerned about with people is to get away from this idea of templates.
Yeah.
And doing something that's more specific to the client.
Yeah, that's right. Because, I mean, look, there's some areas of any trust that I develop that are standard. Okay, so for example, every trust I create gives a trustee a banking power. Well, that banking power is the same in every one of my clients' documents because there's a statute behind the authority that I use for somebody to have the power to go to a bank as a trustee and as a successor trustee. So we can call that is quote unquote templated. But what is more difficult in, you know, from my perspective, Mark, is when we just use standard or basic language on how do we take care of a client if they encounter a disability. So if they have a health issue during their lifetime, are we giving sufficient directions to a successor trustee? How comfortable is that successor trustee? Do they know their boundaries? And have we expressed well what the client desires or how they desire their money to be utilized in care? What if we have a client that has a very, very strong value that they want to leave something behind as an inheritance, even if it was just a little bit, just as an expression of love. But yet, then we have a successor trustee that is burning through all the money without that consideration. Mm-hmm. So competing values of the client oftentimes need to be expressed in greater detail instead of just a simple phrase of, hey, trustee, use the money that whatever is in my trust for my best interest. And that's what I see a lot of. I see a lot of basic standard language in areas where there's a lot more expression that we need to pull out. Mm. So every document has some aspect of being a template, right? But the question is, there are areas that are far more important. So what are we doing with those more important areas? And of course, it takes a longer time to ask more in-depth questions. It takes multiple questions of working through what a client desires. So through this discussion, I want to pull some of those things out. What would it look like to walk in and have that discussion? And again, why do I ask these questions and what are we trying to get to?
Well, what's interesting is one of the first questions you ask is what to name a trust.
Yeah.
Why is this important?
Yeah, so the name can hold a lot of value for somebody. I have clients that just use something as straightforward and simple as my trust is the Grant Family Trust. Mm-hmm. It's not complicated. So I talk to clients about, well, what do you want the name to be? Are you seeking for a little bit of anonymity? So, for example, in public records, when you purchase a home, the deed is then recorded with the county, and that becomes public record. So how do you find where somebody lives? You go to public records. It's all in black and white. So maybe someone has the desire to have some anonymity. And they may not want to call their trust by their name. They would rather come up with something different. Now, here's the thing that we talk to clients about as well, which is this name is going to be what you use for the rest of your life. And if married, for the remainder of both of your lives. I see a lot of trusts that are named, for example, my wife, Mariana. So our trust in other people's systems would be Paul Grant and Mariana Grant, Revocable Living Trust, dated July 1st, 2000. Man, is that a mouthful. Mm-hmm. Do you want to write that out every single time that you open up a new bank account or open up an investment account or use it as a beneficiary designation on your IRA or if you were to purchase something different? I mean, that takes a mile long of paper just to spit out. So I see that a lot, actually. But yet, what if I were to die first, then that trust continues for the benefit of my wife. So now I've died, and for the rest of her life, she gets to look at my name on every asset and on every bank account and on every statement that comes to the house, because it uses Paul Grant and Mariana Grant, revocable living trust, dated, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, is that what I want my wife to be doing, is looking at my name in perpetuality because we developed a trust? So even the name itself needs to be well thought out. So, so this is a name that is going to continue on, and this is a name that is going to potentially be in public records. So do you want some anonymity? Do you want, and we want to think through a name that is going to be, for most people, easily used. So oftentimes it's just going to be something like the Grant Trust or the Grant Family Trust.
What would be another option then that you, for instance, it, you would use if you don't want to call it the Grant Family Trust?
Yeah, you can use anything.
So and, what would be that? What would be an example?
I don't know. People have used their pet names before. People use something that is in, that's a joke inside the family. People have used scripture. The For Jesus Trust. And I mean, there's a ton of different creative ways to go about it. And here's the deal. It doesn't matter if there's another Grant Trust out there. It doesn't matter if there's another For Jesus Trust. I don't know what any other name that you want to think through, because every asset that is in my trust uses my social security number. And I am the trustee along with my wife. And so there could be another Paul H. Grant out there. As a matter of fact, there is another Paul H. Grant out there. I know this because he does not have very good credit. And so if you are listening, Paul, come on, bro. Help me out a little more.
Yeah, there's another Mark Holland out there, too, in our community. He's a doctor, and people call me thinking, oh, wow, I found my doctor's phone number. Yeah, I can actually call him.
Yes, exactly. I hear him on the radio, too. That's fantastic. Yeah. So, okay, but why are you not afraid to go open up a bank account in under the name of Mark Holland, and you think through, oh my gosh, what if the doctor can get at my bank account? No, we don't have that fear, because we know that there's a social security number behind it, ID behind it, and there's protocols. Same thing with the trust. So it doesn't matter if there's another trust with the same name out there, because the same security protocols, the same your social security number is still going to be attached to that asset. But all of that to be said, there are considerations that are much deeper than just picking any old name. And so when I started my career, I used longer names and use both husband and wife name in it. And all of a sudden, I had my first death, and I go, oh my gosh, now the wife is going to be stuck with her deceased husband on all of her assets. So I quickly changed that practice to become more simplistic. Something is typically best that is close to your name for usability, but it doesn't matter at all. And so you can find a name that is not utilizing your family name and utilizes something different, and that is going to be the name of your trust. But we're going to be using that for the rest of your life. Now, can you change the name of a trust? Last thing before we hit under break, can you change it? Absolutely. You can always come in. We can always restate your trust.
That might be kind of complicated, though.
And it can be to a degree, because then what we need to do is we need to go back to every asset and say the name of the trust has changed. So you have to go through what we call the funding process again. But if it is important to a client, then it's worth the journey. So if you are out there and you've used someone else, you have a trust that has been around for a while, and you go, gosh, I'd really like to change this name. Yep, it is possible. We can do that for you. But the name actually really does matter, and we have to think about it strategically. Those are a couple of the reasons why.
Okay, some of the foundational questions you need to ask when creating a trust. And if you're interested in Paul's services, how do they get in touch with you, Paul?
Head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts. There's upcoming educational opportunities, ways to communicate with us, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
Back with more of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Can I avoid probate? Will I lose everything if my health becomes compromised? How do I preserve what I have for me and my family? Will the government take it all? This is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. These are some of the most common questions we get on a daily basis, and there are solutions for all of these issues. It is time for you to protect your family and what God has placed under your stewardship, and we can help. Go to legacyandfaith.com to find out more about our services and upcoming educational opportunities. That's legacyandfaith.com.
Your photos, slides, scrapbooks, and home movies are invaluable and irreplaceable. Barry Kenny here with the Bear Services. Call us to save them as digital files to be stored electronically and shared liberally. We will even come to you so they stay in your possession. Go to thebearservices.com for more information. That's thebearservices.com.
Hi, this is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. You're listening to a previously recorded show, Foundations of Estate Planning. I hope you enjoy it.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant, and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, looking at foundations. Foundational questions to ask are that you will be asked by Paul if you come in and create a trust with him. And this is information that has to do with the creation of trusts, not wills.
Yeah, that's right. So a will, there's only two documents that any estate planner can use to help you create an estate plan. One is called a will, one is called a trust. Now, a trust is an instrument that is immediately ready to be used, and it has a different title to it. So that's the naming convention that we just talked about. But if you used a will package, we had a will, financial power of attorney, medical powers of attorney, all those things that come together in a will package, then a will is a document that simply is, when I die, this is what I want to have happen. So there's no naming convention. Now, sometimes an attorney will try to stick a trust inside of a will called a testamentary trust.
Inside the will.
Yes, yes. And there's only a few times that I would ever suggest that that is done. But again, it's an old template model from the 90s. It's still floating out there. Attorneys still do it. And even in those, the trust is rarely named. It's just kind of develop this trust if I die. And so, but that still leads you to probate, and there's a whole host of messes with using a testamentary trust. So when we're talking about naming convention of a trust, that's called a revocable living trust. It's revocable. You're in full power and control. A living is that we're going to use it right now. There's instructions on how to care for you and at your passing. And then trust is the instrument. And by the way, that instrument stands alone. So it's almost like a person in and of itself. So that's why it needs a name. Mm. So you're correct. With wills, we don't name a will. Even if there's a trust tucked into it, I've rarely seen somebody actually name that trust. But revocable living trust, we do get to name that. We get to title it because all the assets need to go into that naming convention so that the trust can hold the assets. That's why we need a different name, or multiple reasons why we need another name.
Well, speaking of names, that's another foundational question you want to get underway and ask people about. And how should a person's name appear in the documents?
Yeah, you would think that this is like why would you even ask that question? But yet, it's quite amazing. What if you've always gone through your life and you've been using your middle name instead of your first name?
Mm.
And so your social security number might be in your full legal name, but everybody knows you by your middle name. You've actually never used your first name.
Mm.
What if you had a nickname?
How common is that? It's kind of common, isn't it, actually? People.
Yeah, using a nickname or using a shortened name. And really the issue is that I have to ask is, how are your assets titled? So have you ever opened up a checking account with the name that you use in public, or have you always used your legal name, right? Do you have other IDs with your public name versus your full legal name?
Pretty common in radio. People have another name.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. It definitely have a pseudo name, right? That's completely not their real name and that they go by for public purposes. But even not that, it's this that some people, because they're a junior or other things, they start using the middle name or they use a different name. So for example, since high school, I've always been Paul H. Grant. I always use my middle initial. That is how I sign my name. That is what I do with my name. In anything on my website, you'll see my middle initial. You'll see it on my letterhead everywhere. So therefore, in my documents, I go by Paul H. Grant. But there's a qualifying factor in the middle there, which says Paul H. Grant, also known as Paul Harold Grant. Mm. And so then I give the full legal name so that the name used can be associated with the full legal name. So again, if somebody used a middle name, we could actually use that in a legal document, but we're going to quantify it by saying they're also known by this name. This also happens during remarriage. So you may have an asset, a 401k or something that is under a maiden name if you've then you get married, or in a previous name. So all of those different names we need to have in the document because we're trying to identify assets to make sure that if any asset ever appears in this person's name, we've got the right person, and that asset can then be captured by the terms of the trust. So yes, it seems really straightforward that you say, okay, well, my name is my name. However, what other names have you used? What names do you go by? And specifically, what names do you potentially have assets or have had assets in that we may have forgotten? Old life insurance policies and things of that nature. So there's much more in a name than maybe what people would realize. And some people have an affinity that they just want Paul Grant. They want Paul H. Grant. They want Paul Harold Grant. I don't know. So how do you want your name to be viewed in the document? But we're going to quantify it by making sure that that document also lists your full legal name as a – it's a, that this person is also known as. And really there's a – sometimes we look at that as competency issues. We look at that to make sure that we have the full legal name for identification purposes. But really the big deal is we're trying to track those assets when we ask that question.
Okay. Another question is, who do you list in a trust as a reference? Do you put in the children's names, beneficiaries, maybe somebody you want to not be associated with your trust in any way?
Yeah, that's right. what happens if you name a couple family members, but then don't name other family members? So I have clients that may not have children, and so they name one sibling, but they don't name another sibling. So then the question comes up, well, do we have to specifically say that we're not leaving something to the other sibling? And so do we have to list all of our children? And so there's a mix in all of this, and there's very different philosophies in the legal world about how to name people, specifically if you're going to disinherit someone. So again, it's a if we're going to talk about how do I disinherit someone, and it's a child, let's start there. We want to make sure that we list that these are my children. So this is everyone that I know of in the world that I have given birth to. So we name them first, but then another sentence would say, I acknowledge this person, but I have intentionally and with full knowledge determined or decided to not leave anything to them. So in other words, we acknowledge their existence. We acknowledge who they are. That we acknowledge the place that they are in the family structure. And then we make a very general statement that says, with full knowledge, I have chosen not to leave something to this person.
How often does that happen?
Well, It happens. It's definitely not a large majority, but certainly it happens. Not all families are healthy and strong. Sometimes we have second marriages, and that first marriage, we had a child young and lost contact with that family. Or there's so many different scenarios that I've ran into. And so what if we have a child who hasn't themselves decided to engage with the family or has drug issues and has caused that issue. So it does happen, unfortunately. So we need to wisely know how to acknowledge somebody, but then also not include them. I've seen other attorneys say, I leave them a dollar. You know, it's like it's this philosophy that says, I didn't forget you. See, I left you a dollar. But I don't like that. And then they're entitled to some accounting, and their whole list goes on of why that's a really bad idea. So we just need to simply acknowledge that I know this person and I've chosen not to leave something. Now, if it's for a sibling, I have other people who leave things to one person but not another, and they're closely tied. I don't feel as strongly about making a statement that says, I know that person, I chose not to leave something. So if I have three brothers. So if I didn't have children, I said, I'm leaving everything to my brothers, but I'm only going to leave it to two of them instead of all three. I'm not as compelled to, as an attorney in the legal realm, to name all three of my brothers and say, but I'm not going to leave something to this brother. I would typically just leave the instructions and what I'm going to give to the other two and not mention the other brother. Are there legal arguments? Yeah, but you know, maybe I'm not leaving something because that brother is not in a great relationship with us. And I can't control people from suing the estate, right? I can't control that. But the document is going to be addressing the issue on the four corners, is what we call it. And there's ways to get at the paperwork to say, yep, I acknowledge that that person was there. We just chose not to put them in the document. So leaving the information, here's the other thing, and then we're running out of time for today, which is blended families. It's really important that if you consider a stepchild, someone that you have not adopted, someone who is not your blood child, if you consider them a child, it is extremely important that you do estate planning, because if something were to happen and we don't have strong language around who you consider a child and who you do not for the purposes of estate planning, then that plan could really cause some problems and some hurt feelings. So naming the people involved is a very important drill. Naming the ones that you don't want, specifically if they're children, would be important as well.
Okay, foundations in creating a trust with Paul Grant. You're intrigued by his approach. You want to find out more? How do people get in touch with you, Paul?
Head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com. There's more information about who we are, ways to communicate with us, past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, and much more, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
It's the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.